Look, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but we will anyway. This time we discuss Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth. Welcome back to Sophomore Lit. It's just like going back to high school, except far less creepy. I'm John McCoy, and with me this time is our special guest host, Phil Gonzalez.
Hello.
Hi, Phil.
Hi.
Phil, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am from originally Houston, Texas. I live in Minneapolis. I have a degree in theater. I work for a nonprofit, and I have my own podcast.
Would you tell everyone what that podcast is and where to find it?
It is called Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bearcast. The website is berenstainbearcast.wordpress.com. It's all about the Berenstain Bears.
This podcast is not about the Berenstain Bears, but it is about theater. It's taken us this long to get to it, but we did read an awful lot of plays back in high school.
Yeah.
And this is a play this time that is near and dear to my heart. It's probably the one book from my high school career that has stuck with me more than any other. It's Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth. Did you read this in high school too?
Well, what's interesting is since I was a theater kid in high school, we read plays as a theater organization all the time. So this was one of the plays that we read out loud, like as a group. Like our teacher assigned us roles. We sat in a circle and we read the whole play straight through as an organization.
I've mentioned this before. At Eureka High School, where I went, there was a class called Workshop of Life in sophomore year, which was a interdisciplinary arts and history class, and that was followed up by another class called American Cultural Studies. They kind of bled into each other, and this was kind of given to us at the beginning of Workshop of Life as this kind of a big ideas play that was going to get us thinking about issues of civilization and culture, and I think it just confused the hell out of everyone.
I totally understand that.
Right. Well, it's an interesting play, but I'm not exactly sure it's the greatest play for high schoolers.
When we read it out loud, I did not like it at all. None of us liked it. It was a incredible slog to get through. To expect high schoolers with no background, no information, just to sit them down with the script and expect them to read it and get any kind of meaning out of it. It's such an abstract, such a bizarre play on first read that, I mean, I'm not surprised that we were just befuddled the entire time. I remember putting it down and just instantly dismissing it as a piece of theater that I would never want to pick up again.
Well, we had the advantage of, I guess I read this in 1984, and the year before there had been a PBS production of this that I think is a wonderful production everyone should look up. It's still available on DVD, starring Blair Brown as Sabina, and it actually has Rue McClanahan in it as Mrs. Antrobus. And for those Castle Freak fans out there, it has Jeffrey Combs as Henry. So there's a lot of good people in that production. Now, this is a play by Thornton Wilder. Thornton Wilder is probably best known to anyone out there, if you know him at all, as the playwright of Our Town, which is put on, I think, by every high school in America. But he also wrote The Merchant of Yonkers, which was later adapted into The Matchmaker, which was later turned into Hello, Dolly. So yeah, he's responsible for that, too. He also wrote a lot of novels, including the wonderful The Bridge of San Luis Rey, which was his first success. And I do recommend that book highly. It's a very short novel, a very beautiful novel, and it shares a lot of the big ideas, concerns that mark this play. Have you ever acted in a play by Thornton Wilder?
I have not. He's one of those playwrights who tends to get done a lot by theater companies that I have not been involved with. His work is so deceptively simple at times that I think he's not done well often, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I think a lot of people tackle his work. Just looking up stuff on The Skin of Our Teeth, I find a lot of high schools have done it. I'm sure some have done it well, but I can't imagine the majority of them have done it well.
Just a little bit more backstory. The Skin of Our Teeth was first performed in 1942, but it was written in the years before World War II at least before America got into World War II.
Right.
And that looms over a lot of this play. And the other thing that's interesting about this play to me is that when it came out, Wilder was accused of having plagiarized Finnegan's Wake.
Yes. It's such an amazing story. The Saturday Review articles by Joseph Campbell and Henry Morton Robinson, the skin of whose teeth, as they referred to it, they're just amazing pieces to read in addition to the play. Like, I think they are as vital to read as the play, just to get this sort of like this immediate response to a piece of American theater by the cultural critics of the time, who just leapt on him as having whether consciously or subconsciously plagiarized a great piece of world literature. It's an amazing. And then when they go into the first article, The Skin of Whose Teeth, they lay their groundwork having just seen the play. And then when the play's published, they write a follow-up piece where they actually break it down like line by line at times. And you really see where he did gain a lot of inspiration from Finnegan's Wake, which of course he was a huge fan of. Like he was one of the scholars of Finnegan's Wake at the time, wasn't he?
I am a big believer in influence. I believe that every work of art is influenced by everyone else, and I don't necessarily think there's any particular shame in wearing your influences openly. I do think it's a bad thing to plagiarize. I don't actually see this work as a work of plagiarism so much as a work in kind. If Joyce set out sort of the project of telling a proto-history of humanity through the day-to-day minutiae of someone's life, although Finnegan's Wake is kind of a waking dream, then this is kind of a similar project, but it goes in very different directions.
Well, and I love what Campbell and Robinson say in their second piece, which is basically they accuse him basically of stealing the plot and the characters and the themes from Finnegan's Wake, but they're also incredibly they admire his ability to mine a very difficult piece of literature. They admire his ability to mine meaning from it and then translate it not only for the stage but for the American stage. It doesn't help that they were currently working on like the first like definitive guide to Finnegan's Wake at the time, and it probably felt like he jumped their game a little bit.
Well, the other major influence on this piece is a musical review that is not well remembered today because very few people remember musical reviews at all. It was called Hell's a Poppin',
mm-hmm.
that I think was started in 1939 or something like that, and it ran for many thousands of performances on Broadway and was eventually made into a movie. But it doesn't really have a existing plot line or an existing script because it was a bunch of loosely connected sketches that just kept changing and changing, kind of like watching Saturday Night Live in the modern day. They kept trying to make jokes that were current with current times, but what it did share with The Skin of Our Teeth was this constant breaking of the fourth wall, this constant reminding people that you're watching a performance. So he was borrowing from very low sources as well as very high sources.
Right. And he was also, like, as has been pointed out, he was also borrowing a lot from himself. Pulmankar Hiawatha, the short play he wrote years before this, has many similar... If you read, like, It and then Our Town and then this, you get kind of this, like... Well, they each contain a sort of an omniscient stage manager character who interrupts the action of the play. These two plays contain representations of classic writers and thinkers that speak to the audience about the themes of the play. He was obviously heading towards this. Like this wasn't a fancy that struck him right before he started writing it. Like he was building towards this as a writer, as a thinker, as a humanitarian, like just trying to get this idea across to the audience. And I think he found a wonderful blend of theatrical style and literary background to sort of synthesize in his mind and create this sort of masterwork of his ideas.
We've talked a lot about the style and the themes of this play, and we haven't talked anything about this play. If you did read this in high school, it probably stuck with you. if you have never heard of it before, you're not alone. It's a play that either you know or you don't. The plot of this is, in some ways, it's very simple, and in other ways, it's very hard to explain, because this is, as we've alluded to, an allegorical representation of man's advancement from the primordial past. And if I offended anyone by using the term man instead of humanity, that was intentional. This is very much a story of man's advancement, and we'll get into that, I guess, a little bit later. It opens, we're told, in the typical American house of George Antrobus in Excelsior, New Jersey.
Yeah, it starts off with a basically like a newscaster, depending on how you present it. It's an announcer setting up the world for you, and they establish that you're in a theater, that you're about to watch a play, and then they set up that this is the house of George Antrobus and his family. They set up that they live in New Jersey in the suburbs, but they also live in the Ice Age, and that they are, you start getting hints that they are the first man and first woman who've been married for 5,000 years, and that their maid is sort of an extension of the character, the character of Lilith, Adam's first wife, and also a representation of the Sabine women. They have a son who is Cain, of Cain and Abel fame, and a daughter who kind of represents, I guess, budding sexuality. But also, they are stock theater characters. They are your traditional suburban family. They're a traditional middle-class family, as you would have seen on stage in many, many, many comedies at this time. So when the lights come up on this interior set, which is a little off-kilter, you're not totally taken aback, because you see a maid who's talking about her master, as she keeps on, the master of the house isn't home yet. You're sort of lulled into a sort of a false sense of security about what this play is, until the first time the maid stops the action to comment on the play in the character of the actress who is playing the maid. And that's kind of the first time the play, you start getting a sense that this play isn't going to be as straightforward as an audience, especially at the time, would have been led to believe.
The maid is, as you mentioned, Lily Sabina, mm-hmm. Named after the Sabine women. And she speaks in aphorisms and chestnuts. This is where the skin of our teeth comes from, is the fact, yes, that she's constantly speaking in these little bits of folk wisdom. And she speaks, as you say, in a very stilted, ridiculous way. This role was actually originated by Tallulah Bankhead, which, mm-hmm, is kind of hilarious when you think about it. But there is also, if you look on YouTube, a bizarre performance of it by Vivian Leigh.
Yeah, I watched that one.
Which is one of the most affectatious things I've ever seen.
It's crazy.
But the thing that's funny about this play is the way that it does move back and forth from the highly theatrical into the conceit being that suddenly the actors are speaking to you as themselves. They either, in the case of Lily, she is constantly befuddled by the play, irritated with the play, angry with the presumptions of the play. Either she doesn't understand it, or she thinks it's overblown, or that the audience shouldn't take its message too seriously because she thinks the message of the play might be upsetting. And in those moments, the dialogue changes to kind of a much more naturalistic, I mean, this is before Strasberg, but this is kind of a proto-method approach.
When I first read this play, God, it would have been very early 90s, it was unusual to read, because this was still the age when teenagers, we weren't steeped in a culture of irony yet. There was no expectation that a play was going to be in any way meta or step outside of itself. That was, especially from an older play, you just didn't expect to encounter that. You know, if you were kind of raised on Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams, you know, as out there as their plays may have gotten, they were still fairly straightforward. And Wilder was very impatient with the way the American theater was going at the time. In European theater, they'd been experimenting with all kinds of wall breaking and messing with the sets and drawing the audience in, talking to the audience, you know, like throwing the audience for a loop, you know, leading you down these like sort of twisty alleyways the way, you know, in ways you wouldn't expect the plot to go. But American theater was really mired in reassuring the middle class that it was okay to be middle class. And there were these a lot of light comedies and like simple dramas that Thornton Wilder was just really rebelling against. And he really wanted to shake the audience up and say, you know, you don't come to the theater to be comfortable. And as a teenager reading this, it didn't make any sense to me that you would have an actor play an actor saying the play wasn't any good. It didn't make any sense to us. We didn't know how to respond to that. Probably much the same way the audiences felt in the early 40s, which was, I don't understand, like, why would you tell me the play I am watching is not very good? From an actor's standpoint, when you have a play like this, one of the most difficult parts of a play is determining what play you want all the actors to be in. As a director, especially, you want to be able to set up the world of the play, making sure that all of your actors are acting on the same stage, in the same play, is kind of the fundamental job of a director. And to make sure that you have all these layers acting in sync with one another, the actors as actors, the actors as characters, not to mention all the jumping back and forth in time, pulling an audience back and forth from suburban New Jersey to the Ice Age to the Great Flood to all the different places that you expect them to go, it's a delicate balancing act. And so when the play looks deceptively simple as far as its plot goes, and as far as like, okay, now they're regular characters, now they're acting as actors, it's incredibly difficult. And I think it's one of the reasons that this play can be in so much danger of becoming a slog, because you have to maintain this distinct level of, well, several distinct levels of characterization throughout. That's kind of my long-winded way of saying it's a very hard play to do.
But what makes this play different than, say, Pirandello or something like that, mm-hmm. is it's a funny play.
It's very funny.
And its funniness relies upon a self-awareness of the corniness of some of the jokes. The jokes are played, in some cases, very broad and very silly. And that's kind of, I think that's difficult to pull off, because you're expecting the audience then to be with you in just 30 seconds later when it becomes very dark and sinister.
Right, because it switches from comedy to drama on a dime. Like, it just turns. Like, it goes from farce to pathos instantly, especially in the second and third acts.
Right. Well, the first act, let's get on with this plot a little bit more, is pretty silly all the way through, although there is a kind of a mounting menace. As you mentioned, this takes place in the Ice Age. Lily Sabina opens with talking about it being the middle of August, but it being the coldest day of the year, that there is word of a glacier coming down from the north, and nobody knows what to do about it. But on the other hand, everyone seems to be going about their day. They get a singing telegram. The mother of the house, Mrs. Antrobus, shows up, and she scolds Lily for having let the fire go out. And we are introduced to the children, Gladys and Henry. And as you mentioned, Henry is Cain, although he isn't named that at first. We do learn pretty early on, though, that he has a mark on his forehead, and he has an unfortunate habit of throwing stones at people. And the other thing we have is the wonderful mammoth and dinosaur.
Probably the most jarring part of the first act, in my opinion, is actually seeing actors walk on stage in like these pantomime mammoth and dinosaur costumes. Like, they're literally there. Like, it's not symbolic at all. Like, here they are, a baby woolly mammoth and a little tiny dinosaur crawling on stage.
Right, and they are treated as the family pets.
And they talk,
yes. They're asked whether they're ready to come in yet or not. And it's all leading up to the big introduction of Mr. Antrobus. We keep mm-hmm. hearing about him as being this great inventor. He's been off, and he's sent a telegram saying that he's invented the wheel, that he was able to, what were the two letters he was able to distinguish between?
M and N. And hadn't he just discovered 100?
So there's a lot of these kinds of crazy, these things that are in some ways anachronistic. On the other hand, things that never actually ever happened at all. But George is a great one for hunches and inventions. And he's also a bit threatening. The reveal of him on stage, he's off stage shouting to get in, sort of like a big bad wolf character, until he comes in, and then it turns back into a domestic comedy.
Right, right. They don't believe it's him outside until he starts screaming at them. Because he shows up singing, and they don't know who it is. And then he starts bellowing like these horrible things about all of his family members. And they're like, oh, it's Dad. There was a, I think the Public Theater did a production with John Goodman in the lead.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, yeah, perfect.
Right.
Like, he's just got that voice. Because, yeah, he comes in, and he's an intimidating presence. He kind of represents, like, all of humanity's, like, technological advancements.
And if he's supposed to represent every man, he's also shown as being highly moody, kind of mm-hmm. bipolar in a way. He's full of plans and inventions and schemes, but he's also just as quick to give up on something if he feels frustrated. And so as a representation of humanity, he's kind of a fickle and moody one.
Right. And I think that, you know, that fits in perfectly with Wilder's attitude towards humanity in general, which is that we're incredibly flawed and incredibly goofy, and we make a lot of stupid mistakes, but we are, you know, we're all worthy of life deep down. Like, we, you know, we're not perfect people in any stretch of the imagination. We're going to make horrible, horrible mistakes. But so he would never show, I don't think he would ever be caught representing humanity as anything less than incredibly flawed.
Towards the end of the first act, the glacier is coming upon us, and Mr. Antrobus wants to bring in a group of refugees, which include Moses and Homer and the Muses. They come into the house, and to make room for these refugees, they have to send the mammoth and the dinosaur outside.
It's Antrobus who wants to let them in, and the mother is, Mrs. Antrobus, is very concerned about letting them in.
Well, she's concerned about her children, and that will become the thing that motivates her throughout the entire three acts, is she will do whatever she thinks is in her children's best interests. Now, Lily, well, let's talk a little bit about her. She is presented as this kind of a highly sexualized maid in the first act, and she's kind of kept around as this kind of an inspiration for Mr. Antrobus. The idea is that Mr. Antrobus needs to have her around to try to achieve things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a, I don't know how to put this, a kind of a antique gender role thing here. You know, we've got this very literal sort of Madonna and whore on stage here, I think.
Well, it's also very explicitly the Lilith character, who was, you know, the first wife of the first man, who is then sent away from the garden and is always sort of out there as this threat. Because I think traditionally Lilith is portrayed as becoming a demon and kind of like a succubus character in Jewish tradition. But to have him, as they say, he raped her back. He kidnapped her and brought her back to the house to have by him. So she's sort of this like threat to Mrs. Antrobus and to the family. But she's also kind of, especially as we go along, I wouldn't say she's a voice of reason, because she remains kind of a threat. But she is definitely a vital component of this very small group. Like, it's obvious that they cannot exist without her, without this presence in their lives, like, as becomes obvious, like, by the third act.
Well, she's also, I mean, to step outside of the play, this is the headline role for the play. And it's, and whenever you see the play advertised, it's always whoever's playing Sabina gets top billing. For a play that is about Mr. Antrobus as the personification of humanity, Sabina has all the best lines, and she's got almost all the stage time. She's constantly commenting on everything, and she's constantly breaking out of character, at which point she's supposed to speak as the actress who's playing her. The other thing I would say is that in addition to Lilith, there is the other part is Sabine from the Sabine Women. And the interesting thing about this is I've never quite figured out what Wilder is on about, that because the Sabine Women as a story is from when Rome was founded as a city. They needed women, and they took them from the surrounding hills, and they took these Sabine women into their fold, and they called it the rape of the Sabine women, but in the classical sense, that just meant carrying off of the Sabine women.
Right.
And the other part of the story is that after a time, the Sabines were pissed off at the Romans, and they came, and they wanted to have a fight with them for what they had done. And at that point, the Sabine women threw themselves between the Romans and their kinsmen. And there's a famous painting by Jacques-Louis David of this, of the intervention of the Sabine women.
I don't know if he was intending it to be like a direct allegory, like allegorically point for point with the original story. But she definitely does play a part in the last part of the play as far as the conflict between Mr. Antrobus and Henry.
Act one ends with the impending glacier and with the actors on stage imploring the audience to bring up anything that can be burned. It's left in this moment of extreme tension as the wall of ice is crashing down on their house. And act two starts again with the announcer, but this time the announcer is reporting from the boardwalk in Atlantic City.
Yes.
At some unspecified time in the future from the first act, it seems as though all the troubles of the first act have been forgotten, because now Mr. Antrobus is in Atlantic City heading a convention of the Order of Mammals.
Yes, and it's that point to me where you're like, okay, this is... The play borrows from biblical stories, but he also makes it very clear in this that this is also borrowing from Darwin's theory of evolution, because, you know, in a somewhat misunderstanding of the theory of evolution, Antrobus talks about how, you know, from the primordial soup, he had to decide whether he was going to have pin feathers or, you know, like what kind of animal he was eventually going to evolve into. And so you have this, to me, at least, it was very telling that this was not meant to stand alone as a biblical allegory, no matter how many times Moses walks on stage, or, you know, like no matter what happens in this act, this is all in service of a greater of a greater point that Wilder is trying to make. He's not just trying to hold your hand and retell Bible stories.
The world of this play exists on so many different levels. It exists in the level of biblical story. It exists in the level of, as you say, natural history, in the level of a continuing domestic comedy. And so George is here leading this convention, and we're told that the other orders of birds and fishes are having their conventions around the world too, that they've sent some envoys on. And it's all set in a backdrop of this festive boardwalk in Atlantic City, where people are being pushed around in Atlantic City roller chairs, and they...
Which I had to look up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know what you're talking... Oh, okay.
Yeah, they appear... Roller chairs appear an awful lot in newspaper comics in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they are most often appear with terrible, terrible racial stereotypes of the people pushing them.
Well, and in a way, that kind of pops up in the show.
It certainly does in this, and I just want to acknowledge that here. In the original text, the gentlemen pushing the cars around are not the most forward-looking characters.
Right.
So in any case, the it's a atmosphere of gaiety and frivolity that's supposed to, I think, represent sort of the 1920s, and everyone seems to be playing bingo. There is a there has just been a beauty contest where Sabina has been crowned Miss America at the beauty contest by Mr. Antrobus. It seems as though all the characters have sort of reset themselves. George insists that he doesn't know who Sabina is, but later Mrs. Antrobus sees her and says, "She looks like Sabina to me. She hasn't forgotten," even if who the characters are seems to have kind of shifted around them.
One thing we didn't talk about from the last act was the daughter, Gladys.
Oh, right.
Who isn't given a whole lot to do in the first act, but the second act has a lot to do with her. This is where in the first act, you start getting hints. You get a lot of hints that the mother really does not want this girl's sexuality to come out anyway. She sees this as a threat. And in the second act, Gladys starts wearing... Is this the act where she... No, the first act where she wears makeup, right?
Right. This is the act where she wears the stockings.
She wears the stockings, yes. And a huge deal is made out of that. And in a way, she's imitating the red outfit that she sees Sabina wearing. What the characters are wearing becomes very important in this act. They make a big deal about... Like, there's a lot of stage directions about the exact kind of outfits that the people come out wearing. That's one thing that really struck me is if you look at the photographs of the original sets, they're very simple. There's not a whole lot of detail. So I have a feeling that a lot of this, they're very focused on the characters in this. And on one side of the stage, you have, what is it, the bingo hall. And on the other side of the stage, you have a fortune teller. So you have they're sort of torn between like this game of chance and then the notion that our futures are all foretold. It's like the stage is completely balanced when the curtain comes up between like this randomness and then a set future. And then everything that happens in the middle of the stage is kind of being torn between those two sides.
The fortune teller is a kind of a central character to the second act.
Mm-hmm.
She only appears in the second act, and she is one of these characters who's going to tell us how to feel about what we're watching.
I tell the future. Nothing easier. Everyone's future is in their face. Nothing easier. But who can tell you your past, eh? Nobody. Your youth? Where did it go? Oh, it slipped away while you weren't looking. While you were sleeping. While you were drunk? What did it mean? What was it trying to say to you? Think. Split your heads. I can't tell the past, and neither can you. But I can tell the future. Apoplexy. Nobody listens. I see a face among you now. It may be you. Next year, the watch spring inside you will crumble. Death by regret. It's in the corners of your mouth. You'll decide that... You should have lived for pleasure, but that you missed it. Death by regret. And what's the future of our friends, the Antrobuses? Oh, you've seen it as well as I have. That dizziness of the head, that great man dizziness, the sudden fits of temper and the long stretches of inertia. I'm a sultan. Let my slave girls fan me. You know as well as I what's coming. Rain. Rain, rain in floods. But first you'll see shameful things. Shameful things. Some of you will say, let him drown. He's not worth saving. But you're wrong. Keep your doubts and despairs to yourselves. Again, there'll be a narrow escape from destruction. From total destruction. Even the animals, a few will be saved. Two of a kind. Two of a kind.
I actually quoted this when I gave my speech at high school. I was one of three valedictorians at my high school, and I got to make my speech, and I quoted this because I thought it would be really too cool for school.
That's funny because I have a friend who was trying to get the trying to become like the class speaker in her senior year and decided to quote from William Saroyan's The Time of Your Life.
Oh my god.
And didn't get to quote from that in a speech to the student body.
You know, I would love to do that later on.
If you ever want to talk Time of Your Life, I can talk Time of Your Life with you for hours. It's an amazing speech. The action stops. She steps down and she just talks straight to the audience. It kind of spells out, I don't want to say it spells out the theme of the play, because there's like 700 different themes in the play. But it comes at about the halfway point of the play, and it speaks a lot to the fact that the notion that you can't tell the past, but you can see the future written on everyone's face, is there's like 100 different meanings in that. And one of the things that I, in doing my research on the play, I read about was the notion that the characters in the play are constantly trying to shut down any relation of their pasts. They're constantly trying to move beyond the past to the extent where, like, Henry isn't even allowed to say his name, his actual name. Like, they're trying to forget the past, and the character, sort of the only one who ever really speaks the truth about who these characters are and where they came from, is Sabina. And whenever she does, she kind of catches herself and just like, And what the fortune teller says in a sense is that your past is past, and you're going to all remember it differently. Where you're headed is so obvious. And as far as the theme of the play goes, where these characters are headed is always obvious, since the play is cyclical. That history is going to keep repeating itself. We're going to keep making the same mistakes. We're going to keep forming the same alliances, and we're going to keep having the same conflicts.
And what is coming down the road in this act is a flood, which, yes, again is linking this to the biblical stories. As you say, the characters are all trying to deny the past. Mr. Antipas, George, wants to just believe that things will just keep getting better and better, and that we can always make our lives better just by ingenuity. And his mood throughout this play, this scene, is one of wanting to enjoy himself and remake himself. His big failing in this act is he wants to chuck it with Mrs. Antipas and move in with Sabina. Sabina, right, is trying to seduce him in this scene. Although, again, we have one of these wonderful broken scenes where the character of Sabina, the actress, refuses to play the scene in which George agrees to leave his wife because she's concerned that her friend is in the audience and that her friend's husband left her in much the same way a while ago.
And it's at this point, with this scene and the sort of this business that follows it, that when you said the first act was very much about the anticipation and the arrival and the dealings of Mr. Antipas, but this part of the play to me is very much about women, their roles, their sort of place in society, their traditional place in society, and where they are as characters and as actresses, leading up to Mrs. Antipas' big monologue about the bottle, throwing the bottle into the ocean that contains all the things that a woman knows, which is sort of this beautiful sequence. But the whole scene with Sabina refusing to do the play to act out that scene because it might be upsetting to her friend, to me, it's a little self-serving, but it's also very compassionate on her part. It's funny, but you also get this sense of Wilder commenting on what is an audience's right? What is it? Do you have a right as an audience member to be comfortable, or should you be challenged? Should things upset you? You know, whose responsibility is it to make an audience feel a certain way? To me, there's so much going on in that moment leading up to Mrs. Antipas's moment with the bottle into the ocean.
That's an interesting speech, because my main point of reference is the 83 production where Rue McClanahan gives that speech, and it got a huge applause from the audience, but it is a kind of a funny speech. To me, it's sort of Wilder acknowledging the limits of his vision. You know, he's kind of saying right there, I'm doing my best, but I can't really ultimately tell the story of women.
Right.
I think there's a kind of a strange otherness that he gives to women in this, about approaching them as though they were some sort of of another species.
Right.
But it is a kind of a touching speech. In some ways it's forward thinking, but I also think it's of its time, in that ultimately it kind of asserts gender as being essential. And
right. But and it is kind of baby steps in that direction as far as the representation of a woman on stage. But I think it's also a great commentary on the scene that preceded it, just because the temptation scene, the temptress scene, the adulterous scene in a play, you know, usually you're left with this choice of like, well, now the woman's got to, you know, she catches her husband in the act and, you know, she's going to leave him, or is she not going to leave him? And Mrs. Antrobus basically defies that notion. I mean, they're kind of done in by nature eventually anyway, but she says, if I can quote from the play, she says, you know, we're not what books and plays say we are. We're not what advertisements say we are. We are not in the movies and we're not on the radio. We're not what you're all told and what you think we are. We are ourselves. And if any man can find one of us, he'll learn why the whole universe was set in motion. And if any man harm any one of us, his soul, the only soul he's got, had better be at the bottom of that ocean. And that's the only way to put it. And I agree that Wilder doesn't seem to know kind of how to address a lot of this, or if he has the space or the time to address a lot of it. But I think he makes up for a lot of that in this moment by simply having the character just sort of break the action completely and say, you know, don't believe the hype. We are not the shrinking violets you always see in plays. You know, like, there's not an A or B option when it comes to how we are going to live our lives. And it definitely is written as an applause moment. Like, if you play it right, the audience is going to be very happy that this moment occurred.
Mrs. Antrobus says this by way of answering George's ultimatum that he's going to leave her and mm-hmm. get, and shack up with Sabina. And then she also presents Gladys's stockings as what happens when the promise of a marriage is broken.
Right.
And it's kind of a funny thing, because the other thing is that Henry has apparently struck and possibly killed one of the gentlemen pushing one of the roller cars around.
Because that's what he does.
And he's kind of disappeared from the scene, and Mr. Antrobus says he doesn't want anything to do with him. As you say, nature intervenes, and mm-hmm. the storm that has been brewing all act long, in the same way that in the first act we keep hearing about a glacier slowly, inexorably coming to Excelsior, New Jersey, all through this act we've been hearing about weather signals and lights on the pier telling you that the storm is coming, and the storm starts to come, and all the animals that have come as delegates to his convention are now two by two. Mr. Antrobus is directing them aboard an ark to get off the
A convenient
pier.
Boat.
Right.
Like, not a boat that he built.
Right.
But a boat that just happens to be there.
And the scene ends with Mr. Antrobus directing the surviving animals onto the boat. Sabina pleads with Mrs. Antrobus to be led aboard the boat, and she says, sure, we've got lots of work to do. They all leave, and it ends with the fortune teller. There's kind of a funny moment where, like, the other conventioneers are floating by and are asking what their fortune is, and she says, keep paddling, boys. She's not going to tell them.
Yeah.
Think about it, Mr. Antrobus, she yells off stage. A whole new world. So twice now the play has destroyed the world.
Yep.
And we open on the third act. The third act does not have an announcer at the beginning of it. It opens on a kind of a bleak, destroyed set, and Sabina pops up from a trapdoor on stage. It's said that she's wearing a Napoleonic costume in the original play. In the 1983 play, I saw her. She was wearing fatigues and carrying a rifle. And she's calling out for the other characters, saying, where are you? The war's over. Is everyone dead?
Right. And we're taken immediately from the mythic and the historic, the ancient, into the immediate. Like all of a sudden it goes from a play that's about ancient history and mythology into something that is literally happening right now.
And it is played very stark and shocking, which is why it's even more hilarious that the next break in the play happens right now in the midst of this extremely tense moment. Is it the director or the stage manager?
The stage manager comes on
and announces to everyone that there's been another problem with the play and that several of the players have taken ill.
And there's this really like shifty moment where you're not really sure exactly who's telling the truth about how these actors got sick. Like, Sabina seems to be the only one who's willing to say that it was, the blueberry pie that got moldy on the bottom. But everyone else is like, oh, we don't, like, I always got the feeling there was something else going on backstage, but we don't really know what it was.
The stage director announces that several of the characters of the play, the players have gotten sick, that they are currently at the hospital. They're expected to pull through, but right now they don't have enough understudies to cover everyone. And then he proceeds to explain what the conceit is of the scene that these characters were going to be in, which is a poetic conceit of these characters representing the great thinkers from history appearing in the night as hours of the night. And what I think is so marvelous about this, and I've seen it many times and I've read it many times, I still don't quite understand how it works, is that Wilder takes this moment to poke holes in this whole idea of the theater as a profound and poetic experience. He actually has the characters who are coming to replace them, which are all sort of stage hands and costume people, come up and introduce themselves and rehearse the scene for a minute. And it's all hilarious. Mm-hmm. And none of that takes away from the fact that when the scene actually comes together later in the scene,
it's amazing.
It's amazing. It's an amazing scene.
I was going to say the exact same thing. It should not work. It's played for laughs. Like, it's presented as a cheesy stage conceit. You're told it's cheesy. You get to see them make it not work. And then when it actually occurs at the end of the play, it's beautiful. Like, it works.
There's a wonderful part where the stagehand is talking about what he thinks the author had in mind, and Sabina comes up with a kind of a bad explanation about it, saying like, oh, I think it's because people, when they go to sleep, have all these thoughts running around their head. And then the woman who is ostensibly the costume hand says, oh, my father was a minister and he saw the run through this, and he thinks that it's about how the thoughts of the great minds are with us even when we don't know that they're there acting on us through the night. And it's like there's a pause and the stagehand says, yeah, that's probably it.
Yeah. And I appreciate that for the very idea that Wilder understands that you don't have to buy into everything that's happening in order for it to be effective. Like, you don't have to understand the meaning behind every symbol. You don't have to understand all the allegory that's taking place in front of you. It's not a puzzle to decode. It's a single experience. Like, it's a whole experience, this play. And it works. Like, yes, taken apart, it all seems ridiculous. Yes, when you stop and think about it, this shouldn't work. This isn't reality. This isn't real life. But as a whole, within the context of the play itself, these moments are transcendent and lyrical and beautiful. And I think that it's nice that he kind of takes the time to point that out so that when it works at the end, it's kind of like him, like, kind of a little way, kind of nudging the audience and going, see?
Right. Huh? Well, to wrap up some of the action here, it does turn out that there has been a war that has happened. When we get back to the action after they are done rehearsing the scene, Mrs. Antrobus shows up, and so does Gladys, who has given birth.
Yep.
And there's a wonderful line where Sabina says, where on earth did you get the baby? And there's a pause for the audience to laugh. We were told that the war has ended, and that in the same way in the first scene, Mr. Antrobus is off stage. They're just kind of waiting for Mr. Antrobus to get back from his office doing whatever it is he's doing. They're talking about people are out celebrating around bonfires out in the town square. And once again, we're back into this kind of strange world that takes place in history, but also takes place in the present time, because we're told that people are going to movies again. And then Henry shows up. And right. just before he shows up, Sabina mentions to Mrs. Antrobus that Henry was the leader of the forces that they were fighting. And Henry shows up with menace in his heart. He says he wants to kill his father. He's fed up with him. He's angry with him. But he's also almost falling over from hunger and exhaustion. And Mrs. Antrobus takes care of him.
Well, yeah, Henry arrives and he's legitimately dangerous, too. Like, where before he had been kind of a... Because he was represented as Kane and you kept hearing about him throwing rocks at people, you knew he was dangerous, but he was kind of comically dangerous. But now he's... They come right out and say the line, I don't know how to say it, but the enemy is Henry. Henry is the enemy. Everybody knows that. And I think that he sort of goes beyond being the sort of like comical bad boy son and becomes more representation of kind of humanity's ability to slide into just evil.
Right.
I don't know how do you see it?
No, I agree with that. I mean, this is a place where his role becomes even more allegorical than it was before. It becomes the kind of the dark mirror of humanity, and that certainly is when Mr. Antrobus shows up. That is certainly the way he sees Henry, and the way that he describes the conflict between what he wants and what Henry wants. There's a line he says, we want the same thing, but until you see it as something that everyone's entitled to, you will be my bitter enemy.
Yeah.
And there is a scene there where Henry and Mr. Antrobus scuffle, and it turns out to be another one of these character-breaking scenes where the actor playing Henry gets out of control and has to pull himself away from the actor playing Mr. Antrobus and says, I can't go on with this. He says, you know, it reminds me too much of my own father. And he makes claims about how when he was a child, his parents beat him and locked him up.
Which is then undercut by Sabina, who says, no, I knew you as a kid. I knew your family. And they didn't do any of that. It sort of brings up the whole question of the past outside the play. Like, who's right? Then who is right?
All art derives from our personal experiences, but there is something kind of untowards for authors and actors to be bringing something personal out into the public. It becomes an issue of how much of that is fair game. I see this as kind of an interesting conflict between the sort of traditional theatrics and the method acting that would be popularized in the coming decade, because of course method acting takes as its basis that you bring your personal experience to the role, and you find that. And here's an example of an actor who can't do that without breaking down and hurting himself or hurting his other actors.
As an actor myself, while reading the scene, I'm constantly thinking, you should have dealt with all this in rehearsal. You should have dealt with all this. This should have come out a long time ago, kid.
Sabina's line might also be a bone being thrown to the poor actor who has to say, my parents beat me and put me in the... she's trying to say, no, that didn't actually happen to the audience, but again... at this point, I'm sure that the audience, if they're following along at all, has kind of learned the rules of this, world.
I would hope so.
Sabina, or the character who plays Sabina, leads Henry, or the actor who plays Henry, off stage, and Mr. Antrobus and Mrs. Antrobus are left alone on stage after Mr. Antrobus's character mentions a little bit about his own personal demons. they settle back into the scene. Uh-huh. And he's talking about how he's lost his spark. He's lost his desire to go on, and he doesn't know if he can get it back. Mrs. Antrobus says that's all that kept us going, is the fact that we knew that sometime we would get back to peacetime and you would have new ideas. And George asks if his books have been saved. Books that had been earlier retrieved in the scene. And she starts, Mrs. Antrobus hands them to George, and he starts reading aloud from these things. And there's Spinoza. There's, who else is there in there? Do you remember?
I can't think off the top of my head.
I always remember Spinoza. But at this point, as he starts to read aloud from these great works of the Western canon, the aforementioned stagehands start coming on stage as the hours of the night. Speaking aloud these words, and it is just a chilling scene.
Yeah, and their monologues. Because we have Spinoza, we have I can't pronounce any of these names, but like Critias. Critias, the beginning of, you know, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. They're all from different points of human thought and different writers from different eras, but they all blend into one another so beautifully. Like they answer each other. It becomes one solid. It's beautifully edited, I guess. He chose the quotes well.
And the themes of these quotes are all on the issue of what it means to lead a good life and what it means to improve oneself. Specifically, mm-hmm. they're about, like, how do you know what is the goal to which you should be tending? It ends with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Yeah. And so we have this ultimate source of creativity and improvement as the note we end on. And then there's an epilogue where Sabina shows up and speaks the exact same opening lines of the play and again addresses the audience and says, this is where you came in. You guys go home. We have to keep going on like this for many, many years yet.
Right. There's a quote from Wilder himself where he says that the existence of his children and the inventive activity of his mind keep urging man on to continued and better adjusted survival, while the ideas contained in the great books of his predecessors hang above him in midair, furnishing him adequate direction and stimulation. You're left with this notion that they're going to keep repeating this cycle as long as there is that stimulation, as long as there is that creative drive in people, because I wouldn't say that it seems like they're stuck in a rut, because creativity is definitely a part of it, like this sort of relearning, this regrowth. And the question that I am faced with is, are they destined to continue the cycle in exactly the same way each time?
I don't know. I
mean, or are they allowed to have learned from the previous iteration?
Well, I think that there is an implication. George himself says, we're trying, we're getting better. You know, we've had mistakes to learn from in his talks with his wife. In the end, the play is optimistic and hopeful about the human condition in a way that is kind of underscored by the fact that the one thing that we haven't touched much on is at the beginning of the play, when the announcer introduces the Antropuses, he calls them the typical American family. Right. And it's interesting that this is not simply, a allegory about humanity, but there is an undercurrent of these are Americans. They are peculiarly American in their optimistic belief that things will get better and that things can get better through innovation.
Yeah. And I would say that extends beyond the page and beyond the action on the page to Wilder's ideas about theater and in general. He's redesigning the American theater as he's writing this. He's trying to get people out of their comfort zones and to say, no, you have to keep creating. You can't rest on your laurels. You have to keep expanding and discovering new things. You know, Wilder was a man of the world. He lived all over the world. And he saw that, you know, that you can't, like, that America was getting content in its place as this sort of young world power, and as, you know, sort of the seat of the new middle class, and that can lead to stagnation, and that doesn't allow us to, you know, that wouldn't allow the cycle to continue. That's where George Antropus gets to at the end, where he's like, I don't want to, I've lost my inspiration. And Wilder knew that it's vital to keep growing and to keep exploring new ideas.
One thing that struck me reading this through again, now that I'm older and I've had a lot of dull graduate literature courses, is that a lot of the stylistic things that Wilder does in this play, which are things that we've touched on about the meta-text, the acknowledging that you're watching a play, the mixture of styles, and the way in which he underscores sort of the symbolism and discusses semiotics on stage, is these are all kind of what you would consider postmodern moves, but the basic theme of the play is highly modern, in that it mm-hmm. it posits a kind of a master narrative for humanity, and that is not something that happens a lot today. I think most people today would say, no, this is your narrative, or this is the narrative of European males.
Right.
I feel a little torn about the play in a way, because now that we've gone through some more time, there's a problem with this play in that it does focus on humanity's story through the eyes of men, through the eyes of European thinkers, through the idea that we're going to achieve some sort of a group enlightenment as a race through, you know, very typically middle century American ideas.
I can understand that. I mean, I can understand the hesitation that I would find wondering whether or not this is a play to produce in today's world. And I'm going to flip that just a little bit by saying that I think that there is a benefit to producing and exploring a play like this, specifically this play, in today's world. It's not a current play. But because we don't see plays that sort of like try to define humanity as an entity anymore, because that's not a popular thing to do, I think that's one of the reasons it comes across as almost very fresh to me. Yes, it's written by a person who comes from a very privileged background. Yes, as open as his mind was, it's still a very limited, very specific worldview that was, you know, very common at the time and still today, that of the white male, upper middle class white male. But I also see that he criticizes his own notions, and he criticizes the world that he was brought up in such an interesting way that it doesn't seem to be making a blanket statement, and leaves as many questions hanging. It leaves more questions hanging at the end than it tries to provide answers. He doesn't seem to be lecturing the audience in it. Or I would think that if I was to see the play produced well, it wouldn't come across that he was trying to provide the audience with answers so much as a sense of hope for the future.
Sure. Now that you're rereading it, I assume you seem to be enjoying it a lot more than you did as a teenager.
I've got a couple of points. One, I want to direct the show. Like, I got very excited like reading it. I was like, oh, I would love to direct the show. Two, it struck me, and I was actually discussing this with my partner, and we've kind of had this conversation before, which is plays, as opposed to like fiction literature that you read in school, plays are a difficult animal, because it's very hard to read a play, especially if you're not accustomed to doing it. And The Skin of Our Teeth is not a very easy play to read. People sometimes confuse a good play with good dialogue, which snappy, poppy dialogue at times, not only does it make a good play, it at times can act against a good play, because witty, creative dialogue that you would find in a novel isn't always very actable. And what Wilder has written is very actable dialogue, but that doesn't make it very readable at times. So you can sit down with this book in your lap, and if you aren't accustomed to envisioning actors and characters speaking these words, and if you don't have a strong idea of who these characters are, it becomes a confusing mess. It becomes just words and M dashes and ellipses on the paper. And then you have these, especially if you have the Sam French edition, it has just these extensive stage directions. Like, it talks you through, like, when they're folding a tablecloth and who walks where and touches who when. But if you're practiced in reading plays, you realize how important all this is. And the point I'm making is that plays are not meant to be simply sat down and read and analyzed. That can be, they need to be that in order to be produced well at times. But plays are meant to live off the page. They're meant to exist on your feet, in front of you, in front of an audience. They are meant to be, they're a group experience. They are a social experience. They are meant to have constant feedback in real time. That's what makes theater different from any other art form. Because you are representing life on stage in front of people, and a play is only part of the way there on paper. And that's what makes, to me, play reading so difficult at a high school level, even at a college level, because learning to read a play is a skill that we don't teach in schools, and we don't teach to our children. We don't sit down with kids and read plays with them. And having read this again and remembering the way it felt as a teenager to slog through it, and this time to be like, oh, this play is alive. Like, this play is vital, and it's vibrant, and it leaps off the page at me now. I'm like, oh, because I have that experience, and I know I can envision it on stage. I would say read plays. Like, even if it's hard, go to the library and just pick out a few plays and just start reading them. Learn how to get that in your system, because there's a huge portion of world literature out there that is in script form. And if you can tap into that, you're going to discover that there's so many more ideas out there in the literary world than you ever thought were there. It takes a little bit more effort and a little bit more time to sort of get the hang of it. And that's the big thing I took away from this, is that we really should be reading more plays.
I'd like to thank my co-host, Phil Gonzalez. You can listen to his podcast, Deep in Bear Country, at berensteinbearcast.wordpress.com. Once again, thanks to Shannon Camp for reading the fortune teller's monologue. You can visit her on the web at shannon-camp.com. The Skin of Our Teeth is copyright 1942, Thornton Wilder. For next time, your assignment is three short stories: The Monkey's Paw, The Lady or the Tiger, and The Most Dangerous Game. As always, everything will be on the final.